You are listening to Jaya Ashmore. You can find hundreds of meditations and talks on my websites, jayaashmore.org, jayaashmore.org, as well as opendharma.org, opendharma.org. All the recordings are offered in the tradition of generosity or dana, and your gifts are welcome. Thank you for listening. Are there any questions or anything to share?
The question that comes up also more often in the last weeks. How can I be all the time in the moment, right here and right now? And without sometimes planning some things, as all we had to come to India somehow, book a ticket and arrange a lot of things to come here. A lot of things are needed every day, every moment. What to do now is this question which urges all the time from somewhere, from the mind, maybe. If I go to toilet right now, or really needed things, what to eat, where to go right now, do I stay here, do I lie, do I sit? Maybe I asked some similar kind of question before, but this is the one now.
And what's your feeling about that? What's your sense?
I remember the last beautiful answer from you. From last week was some specific urge of decisions from inside somehow, the living decisions, where the mind is not deciding much, then seeing, watching how it is deciding, how it is moving, how it is wanting. But somehow, for the step right into the airplane, are some more things to plan, I guess. Maybe the mind will find out, okay, where does this body want to go now? And the body doesn't know, it just goes, and someday it lands up in the airplane, but it should have bought maybe a ticket or whatever, you know, this... some plans need to be done for maybe for the next month, how to pay the rent. If I just follow my body, maybe it just goes for food and it goes for nice people, it goes for entertainment, for the beautiful sunset. It will go, yeah, to the toilet, maybe I said that before, but those are the things every day needed to be done. Maybe then it's happy.
So it. What I hear is two different words that maybe there can be like more experientially defined. So with planning, feeling how there's different kinds of things that we call planning. And sometimes there's a quality of a plan that comes, we could say, out of the silence. And this can be part of a skill that we kind of learn when we tend to be more receptive for those kind of right, great idea. Thank you.
So this wow, I have the plan now. It just came.
It hopefully eventually is less and less wow. Although there's the appreciation, there is the wow in it, but it's also so many. It's everything that there's less and less about how spectacular that is, because it's going to the toilet. It is wow, but not. Not so many fireworks and more like candles or whatever. Stars or something. And similarly, I think we could feel the quality of the useless planning. The planning, because I'm nervous, my mind is like, okay, wants to do something so that I don't. And then it's interesting, so that I don't what? And that could be it, so that I don't feel the anxiety or the fact that I don't know, and no matter what I decide, there's the unknown part, me, or whatever it is. And so what I find is that there's a way of, so the practice of like noticing when we're sucked into the unfruitful planning. And if we even pause for a moment, it's not always possible to, but like if we can kind of get a sense from the side, we can really tell this is not going to help at all. I'm not going to have a good idea. It's coming out of the anxiety, which then there's different things we could do. We could unravel into the anxiety and feel that there's really caring about, really wanting to be there for someone, or that it be simple, or there's a caring that we care so much that it turns over into pressure through fear. And so unlocking care and fear is another way to describe deep rest, or another way to describe practice, another way to describe the secret of life, or whatever. That we are allowed to care as much as we do. And sort of the only way to bear that is by unlocking it from the fear. And we're allowed to fear also. Fear can be there, but fear in the arms of care is much different from care in the arms of fear. So from fear planning, still we might sometimes, also depending on the kind of fear, get a good plan. But feeling the quality when it's like just burning off energy, then it might be really good actually to come back to now, so to speak. And from now, we may get a really good plan for next month, next year, whatever. That's my experience, is that in now is when I get good plans. From silence, that it's where I go to find out what my plan is going to be. And then it's also where I go to find out, is there a plan yet?
Is it possible to make
Is there anything we can really count on yet? And often, though I wish, like right now, I could buy those tickets. Not that there's internet to do it here, but anyway. I do wish I could just get that done. When I go into now, so to speak, to feel like, is it ready? Recognizing it's not ready, so there's really no point in pretending that it is. And it might be problematic that it's not ready, and I might need to hang around that place a little more, really aware that it's important. You know, I don't want to miss the moment. But a lot of the time it's just so much unnecessary tension and distraction and like misuse of our energy. So there was planning, that checking what are the kinds of planning, and then there was another word you had that I was wondering about in the second part of what you said.
I don't know this, but the one what is coming up now, if you just said, as I understood, you really want to buy the tickets, and maybe it's not meant to buy these tickets, but you want. So
could
who
be.
Wants to this? And also somehow to, I don't know if you hesitate with the word surrender, I love it, to surrender as it should come, it should, it
yeah.
will be.
Of course.
Also in the same thing, there could be five different things I would love to do.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot do everything. This is my luckiest, worst problem I have. Just a beautiful choice and not able to do everything. But it's not possible to decide these things now, although it will be maybe in 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be seen how it how it can happen, because it's not possible to do it now. You said all the time, as I understood, it's out of anxiety to wanting to know and to plan. What is going to be in 1 month, or what is going to be in 1 year. Maybe it's also somehow, does it really need to be fear or anxiety that Maybe it's just a full habit of the mind wants to know. Because everybody's asking, what are you gonna do next? Everybody. Mm. However, the answer can be, I don't know, I will see. That will be maybe more the habit in future. But is it all the time out of anxiety, out of fear?
I was giving the suggestion that that's often the case, but trying to suggest that you experientially know for yourself. And then it can be that it's more like a habit than really like a very live anxiety, but still then the habit, what kicks the habit in? Mm. What makes it go on?
Some assurance.
What's the function of it?
Yeah, some safety, some assurance. Mm.
Let me just feel what was the other word that I was wondering about.
Planning, be in the moment right here and right now.
Just let me feel. Okay. Thank you. Body. You were talking about letting the body decide. And I think it's interesting to go really more experientially what that means and whether the body is separate from the mind. In both in terms of, let's say, weakness and in terms of strength. So the body might, when you said, let's go with the body, but maybe the body only is interested in food and toilet, for example, etc. That's our idea of the body. Yeah. But I think in the experience of what you're describing, it's not just going, you're not feeling for what the biology is urging towards. Which even then, I think the requirements are much more various than food, toilet, sex, survival. I think like there's beauty and rest and so on. Etc. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think mostly when we talk about feeling what the body does and enjoying that way of deciding. It's actually a way to feel something that's not programming happen, which is a body-mind decision, if you want to call it that.
Which is the planning decision, or which is the mind decision?
Well, planning now, you have your job of checking what does that mean.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. The feeling you were describing, feeling which what the body does, which way it goes, and letting it
body kind mind.
Of come. And I'm saying when you say body, I think you might mean body mind.
That can be the programming.
It can be the programming, which would be the weakness, and it could be something other than the programming, more liquid, that comes through. Either way, it could come through. And this, again, we come back to, well, how do I know?
Yes.
And it's through experience, feeling in the body-mind, one of the ways, is feeling for the kind of tone. The body-mind does have a tone when we're with the wholeness, so to speak. It has a tone of wholeness, even if what it's going towards is something that's challenging and we feel shaky, but there's still a very subtle kind of pull. Whereas so easily, something that seems so much the same can be programming. And then we have the like in Ayurveda they talk about having these cravings that are the reverse of what we actually need. And so we could feel like this is this very wholehearted urge towards a particular food of some kind. And that easily goes unquestioned.
And
until we get sick on
it's the destructive urge somehow.
Yeah.
Mm. So it is the nice answer I love to go along with, as the week before, to distinguish between the programming wantings and the subtle feeling this is right. Although it can be a tough way, but this is the right touch. As I'm sitting here now and deciding to come here, it feels very right.
And just also slowly opening out words like right.
Mm.
As you said, there might be more than one right. Like it's so easy that we still, the pressure comes because we think there's the one right way that I have to get it right at the right time, or And as you also said, there could be many rights, so to speak, or mm-hmm. then is it called right, or what is it?
Mm-hmm.
and also, you used the word that wanting, but in the sense of like what I would call like that, we could say true nature, or that in us that is in touch with the benefit of all.
Mm.
So that friendliness, that liquid friendliness that's in us. You were saying wanting to.
I didn't want to use the word urge again.
Which either one is fine. I'm not, but it, in, including those urges or whatever that are not wanting to, that's programmed or unprogrammed.
Mm.
So just to keep opening out, it's easy when we put something into words and it fits in one moment that we get stuck with those limitations of those words next week. So, and it feels like right, the word right would be good to like untangle and fluff up and into good enough, workable, fruitful.
For me, it sounded also the I decided to come here. Sounds also for me the one thing as you explained now, I decided.
Yeah.
Thank you.
There's a poem by Dogen. Two of them really that fit. The one that I was having the feeling for first is called Bowing Formally. So in the Zen tradition, there's all kinds of formal bowing that goes on. But to feel the lifetime of someone like Dogen, who was just so devoted to his practice and teaching, and where that formal bowing was part of his life that he had integrated. So it's a poem called Bowing Formally. A snowy heron. Do you know what a heron is? I don't have like located people who's English. Or do we all have? No, a heron, a really big bird, water bird. What would be anyone? Heron, do you know heron?
Like a stork.
Like a swan?
No, it's a really big long-legged water bird. And I think, you know, human tall is part of the, it's a substantial bird. And it's a lovely shape. And I think has kind of connotations. It has it's associated with beauty and gracefulness. And so a snowy heron on the snow field, where the winter grass is unseen, hides itself in its own figure. A snowy heron on the snowfield, where the winter grass is unseen, hides itself in its own figure. It's like a poem that erases itself. So a gesture that is about being humble and respecting or honoring, and maybe not having, because the hands are doing something else other than having. And where there can be a gesture that is not about confirming something and like nailing it and putting a period at the end and putting it on the wall and signing it and everything. We can photocopy it or take a picture, put it on Facebook. Like the other kind of lusciousness, we had that word last week, of something that kind of, we could say, trusts or knows itself or I guess trusts that it can kind of do the opposite of confirmation. And of course, a hiding that's not covering something up. Hiding itself in its own figure, it's actually, it's revealing something that we could say, it's revealing its true nature, it's revealing spaciousness, it's revealing gracefulness. And hiding itself in its own figure is just delicious. Because usually, we still, even though they say emptiness is form and form is emptiness, we want it to be two different things. And we want emptiness to be more cool than form. Or form more cool than emptiness. And so a bowing that's a snowy heron in a snow field where the winter grass is unseen, nothing is pushy. Nothing is grabbing for our attention, and yet that ungrabbiness is so lusciously attractive. And the hiding itself that is revealing something else in its own figure. So in the beautiful form. It's not a like erasing figure. Because we don't like it, it doesn't fit into our idea of emptiness. And we could even let our sort of, so we had last week that Mary Oliver line of let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And I think we could also have let the soft animal of our body feel what it feels, like really know in texture, to really allow that way of knowing, which for now mostly is so unconscious in us. We're unaware of how much the felt physically, like touch sensation, informs our thinking and emotion. And so I can say a little bit about that, but just the textures of this poem, that through the words the body can feel. So a snowy heron. So of course there's the coolness, but like the fluffiness and then the feather, the feathery and yet solid. In the snow field. We can let it take us somewhere. It takes us somewhere and we can feel that. We can start to practice feeling that. It's happening and we're unconscious of it because we haven't trained that. Where the winter grass is unseen. Hides itself in its own figure. So just briefly to mention some of the studies that have been done about how much the sense of touch, which is the basis of all the other senses. All the other senses are also senses of touch that are specialized, but the sense of touch that we usually mean, where we feel the texture and the density and the weight and the lightness and so on. So there was a study where people were supposedly getting interviewed for jobs. I guess they might have, maybe they knew that this is a psychological study. I don't know how they set that up, how deceptive it all was, but anyway. People were going in as if to be interviewed for a job, and people were sitting or standing as if interviewing people for jobs, and both sides of this were subjects in this psychology experiment. The interviewer and the interviewee were both subjects, were both being studied, okay? And especially the interviewer. The interviewer was given a clipboard. Do you know what a clipboard is? Like a, well, let's just say it could be like a notebook. Something hard on top of that was the paper that they're taking notes or looking at the resume or whatever of this person that they're interviewing. So they're in a position of authority interviewing, and they have a clipboard in their hands. And they have, let's say, also a certain chair that they're sitting in. Depending on the weight of the clipboard was their assessment of the interviewee. Yes. If the clipboard was heavy, the candidate was a serious person. They had some substance to them. If it was a light clipboard, the person who was being interviewed was clearly, you know, not serious, taking things a bit too lightly.
This is a conscious thing?
Of course not. No, the interviewer is, of course, making it like a very careful decision based on the questions that they're asking and the way they're listening and hearing those responses, and completely unaware that, according to the study, what was the most, the correlation that made was, I don't know how to say that, whatever, what seemed to be the main factor in the assessment of the interviewee was the weight of the clipboard. So this is us. Let's not just say, oh, those people. This is us, right? And so why not, even if it's hard or even if it's easy, why not awaken our ability to sense what the body is taking in and what it means to the body, or what it would start to mean translated into the mind if we are not careful? So, because we might miss some really, really substantial friends just because we're holding a paper plate of food instead of a china or steel plate or whatever. And we might take some other people really seriously who are a waste of our time. Are there any questions so far at this point? Or anything to share?
It's very difficult to believe for me that this is true.
So check it out.
Because
it's my similar
really wants this job.
Similar answer
this
as
really
usual.
It's a serious job applying.
So don't accept it, but check it out.
I just read similar studies, and there's another very similar one about holding a hot drink versus a cold drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot exactly the fact that there's a distinct correlation in the type of interaction based on the temperature of the drink.
Mm-hmm.
That was really good.
Yeah.
I don't know if it even thinks of these studies to begin with. I mean,
well, I think these particular studies are really intelligent ones. I think they could really make a difference in our lives, whereas some of them
yeah,
seem mean sometimes. this seems like it opens up a whole world of potential for less conflict and more openness, kindness, and real intelligence.
Yeah.
And it's partly just that questioning. So many times I have the feeling that what we think we are is this rickety little wooden house on top of a huge jellyfish. And we think we're that little rickety house, and like, whoa, we're sliding all around, and why can't I get this thing to go over there and get enlightened, you know, now, so I can relax, etc. And just maybe letting that rickety house fall apart, or keeping it for a party or whatever someday or whatever, but like inhabiting the jellyfish, that huge jellyfish, that huge sensitivity. And maybe we can even push the metaphor like a tiny, horrible bit more, just for fun. That I don't know if all jellyfish, but some jellyfish, according to my son, who's 9, don't actually die. They're not programmed to die. They only would die if they get eaten. They just keep going forever until they get eaten. So that kind of maybe in that sensitivity, which feels so, in the sensitivity, so vulnerable, that we don't want to go there, we don't want to admit. It seems so like yucky and primitive. And yet from the perspective of seeing the primitive ways we're translating our experience into what we think of as these sophisticated decisions and judgments of ourselves and other people, all the time, in case you haven't noticed by now, which I guess you have. It can be so hard. What's primitive? A rickety little house that would, like, try to stick on top of a jellyfish. If it would be like a child's game, a little fort, let's see what we can build out of what we've got here, just for fun, to have a feeling of being inside something. That would be honest and maybe healthy even. To play with having a sense of safety. But it we don't take it that way, we don't live it that way. So there's another Dogen poem that maybe brings out more some of this jellyfish quality, so to say. And the title of the poem is very like technical Zen. We'll have to like make sure we understand. And then the poem is just a lovely poem. So the title is On Non-Dependence of Mind with a capital M. So all last week we were talking about the interdependence of everything. And here they're saying the non-dependence of mind with a capital M. So maybe we'll have the poem and then figure out what the title is instead of the other way around. Water birds going and coming. Their traces disappear, but they never forget their path. Water birds going and coming, their traces disappear, but they never forget their path. On non-dependence of mind. How do you feel with the title? Does it kind of make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So we could just call it on non-dependence of whatever you want to call that thing that's not dependent. In contrast to everything that is. dependent, that is coming and going, that is disappearing without a trace. And then that feeling that in the Heron poem that something was more backing up and that was attracting us into something trustworthy that's not a thing. So this poem is giving also, so there's what's coming and going and disappearing without a trace. Let's just have that as real. All of us, as we think of ourselves, are coming and going and disappearing without a trace sooner or later. And every day. This breath, for example, that thought. But right in the same place, the same birds and their offspring, like if we want to go again, take the metaphor a little bit too far, almost. Except wonderfully true, that birds and butterflies that have never been somewhere find their way to that exact same. And maybe that there's a resonance in you of that.
Birds and butterflies find their way to which exact same place?
I can't remember if I can't promise I'm getting exact the details, but the, for example, among so many others, the monarch butterflies, the life cycle, the daughters or granddaughters of those butterflies that started out in Mexico and then went up to Texas or whatever. They've never been to Mexico, and they go to Mexico. And they not only go to Mexico, which is a big country, they go to that same tree.
Same tree.
As far as I remember. But let's say that same
birds,
area,
birds
forest.
I've read before as well, that birds would be.
It's probably so different in different species, but there's some kind of precision.
Yeah, they go to the same. I've heard that when birds are migrating, they go to the same tree, same branch of the same tree every year when they're migrating. They
even along the path.
Yes, along the
path. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Salmon too, right?
Right.
Salmon,
yes,
yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Salmon go back to the place where they were born. Right?
Well, don't they go back to the place that their parents were born?
Yeah.
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 Exactly, yeah.
Swim against the water.
Yes.
The opposite direction, and yet they reach.
Not only they jump, it's amazing. And that can just be inspiring when it's a hard day. Yeah, that's a really good one.
Was that from fish? What was the last?
The salmon fish?
Oh, salmon. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
The parent, let's say what's going to be a parent is born. It goes downriver out to sea, I think also to a same place in the sea, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, whatever. They have babies who then go up the river that they had not been up, except maybe as the sex cells or whatever. They go up the river, they go up the waterfalls, they get through the grizzly bears to where their parents were born, which is just perfect, like scientific zen or like biological zen.
And then they die.
And then they die, yeah. Without a trace. Or we could say, with the traces of in everything, they become grizzly bear and eagle.
Where do you find our way back below the programming to
where we belong? To our
masters,
original, sorry, yes. No, please.
Many masters, many lives, the book actually mentioned that souls actually again meet.
Also, we find each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
Souls meet?
Yeah.
Yeah, like when we born again, our soul will be, like, if somebody is harmful to us, in next life he is again going to, he or she is again going to.
Okay, so we meet the same beings over and over again.
Yeah. And we learn over the lives.
Hopefully. That's what we hope to find, like that way out of repeating.
Yes.
And so for some people, the idea of past lives is just an idea. For some people, it sort of feels true or is true or whatever.
Yeah.
And even the idea of soul for some people is a yes or a no. And still, I think we can, even if we would go to, let's say, psychology, what I notice is it seems like wherever you go, there's your family again. At that restaurant for that half an hour, and then walking home, and then your next door neighbor in the hotel, if you're traveling. I'm trying to remember what that was like when I used to do that, etc. Or the feeling of finding each other.
Yeah.
Whether, who knows if we met in a past life, but there's that feeling as if the richness of finding each other, of being together. Is a deep coming home. Give something more than what we're almost ready for taking in. And there's a story that I love of past lives and there's a couple of them. So, okay, we've been talking about bowing and humbleness, so that we'll go in stories around Vashisht, who was a guru of Ram and his family, the royal family. And Ram's brother, Lakshman, is maybe, let's say, a little more fiery. And he's the younger brother also. And he is given an urgent message to go urgently call Vashisht, the guru, to the palace, let's say. I'm now telling the story in the tradition of where I grew up in the southeastern United States, a storytelling culture, and also the tradition of one of my teachers, Papaji, who every time he told the story was different, so forgive me if it's different from your version. And so Lakshman's got his purpose. And I think he liked having a purpose and being good at it and getting it done. And so he's galloping off on the best horse to go call Vashisht, and he has the ring of the king as the sign to call Vashisht back, to call the teacher to the palace. And Lakshman's so busy with his purpose, his important purpose of calling the guru, that he doesn't even get down off the horse. He's just like, come on, we gotta go. And here's the ring. Vashisht just probably just doesn't answer, which is sometimes such a good way to answer. Maybe his answer was silent. And so Lakshman like throws the ring into the pot by the door or whatever. Cling. And the sound is not of just ring on pot. It's ring on ring on ring on ring on ring on ring. And so he gets curious and he what's that? Maybe by that time he gets off the horse to go look or whatever. And in that pot are all the rings of all the lifetimes before that same scene happened. And Lakshman didn't get off the horse to ask nicely. He just threw it in. And so the invitation is not to repeat the stuff. Even if we're busy and important and all that. Anything else left?
I sort of lost the thread between the poem and then what we've been talking about since.
Okay. The repetition?
Just like the non-dependence of mind,
mm-hmm.
and then all these stories about coming home. And
so the non-dependence of mind, the birds that don't forget their path,
mm-hmm.
and also the resonance of something in a human being that within all the comings and goings that are disappearing without a trace, and with the help of that also, those all that conditioned arising, something is pulling us to our original face, original mind in the Zen kind of language, which then we could call home if we want, or whatever you want. To be in or be in harmony with the way things are. And what's in the way of the pull home, what's in the way of the non-dependence, that non-dependence of mind, so the way that some subtle pull, if we can call it that, keeps arising as if from out of nowhere, not only from this practice or that guru or that job or whatever, but it's somehow not dependent on anything, something keeps calling, pulling, so subtly that if I'm busy with an important job, I will not hear it. And I will get caught up in those things that are coming and going and disappearing without a trace, wasting my life again. Does that put it together?
Yeah, and this was sort of the active component, like having the path be something that was being pulled towards. I didn't get so
okay.
much in the poem.
Well, they never forget their path.
Yes,
means they're flying somewhere. But it's also fine to, it's in a way better to question that sense of going somewhere, especially when we're talking about home. Or an original nature, original face, original mind. Something that actually is just right here underneath all of our crap.
So home isn't necessarily a physical place. It's very long.
How can it be a physical place? We all have experiences of something called home, where we can't be ourselves. And we're not encouraged or even allowed to even say a word from our deepest truth. But if we think of the moment of Lakshman, for example, on the horse, what exactly would be helpful would be like a pause, a stopping of the going. Pause in the purpose and the importance, and just receiving, like, where am I? What am I? Where am I? I'm here, the guru is there, right there, and what am I doing? I'm calling the guru to my home. Even the purpose that I had, I'm completely not in touch with. The purpose was no problem. Just like the figure of the heron is no problem. It doesn't block that disappearing into spaciousness, wholeness. But exactly on the horse, a moment of receptivity, even to my purpose, that otherwise my attachment to it was getting in the way, or my busyness with it, my basing my sense of importance on what I think is important in my task, if to tie it back to yesterday and that thing about lack and all. That's when we get caught up in importances, because we have questions about the preciousness of this life. Okay.
Something that where I get stuck, and I guess it kind of gets back to what he was saying in terms of making a decision and having a plan, and in regards to what we're talking about now, is when we're plagued by doubt or wavering, indecision, confusion, then it can be really difficult to know those pauses or what. You know, every little fork that we come to, okay, which one is the decision that I keep repeating again and again and making that mistake versus which one is the way, you know, home?
Yeah.
That can be sometimes just really, really confusing.
Yes. I like this phrase of like dipping into silence in case something comes up, some clarity comes up. but it, I think it's a matter of being willing to be wrong, make mistakes, learn by experience, and continually opening out words like decision and right and wrong. And so even when, like actually just today, there I have a few very, very difficult situations that I'm faced with, that I need to, with someone else or alone, come to some decision at some point soon. And just today, this really great idea came, and it was like, oh, that would be so good. I never thought of that before. Cool, I look forward to sharing that with the other people involved in the situation. And then I got some more news coming in that just cut that one off, that great idea. So it's somehow, again, maybe if we come back to what I was saying about the felt texture in the body, the felt texture of doubt, and even a good idea that actually, well, it still could work out, but there's some information now that looks like that good idea is not going to fit this situation anytime soon. But the good feeling of that there could be a way that could come out of nowhere, that the path. So with the migratory birds, they have their fixed path. With us, it's not a fixed path. It's not already, no one has been there before, so to speak. We're not following our parents or grandparents, even if we had a more traditional culture and outwardly we were following, but it's even more prone to doubt because it's exactly what no one else did. It's that original in that sense too, that step that's happening now. And the shakiness that goes with that is something we get accustomed to through practice. But just the sweetness of a good idea came up. And so then being kind of in tune with the situation in a way that there could be a way that works for everyone somehow that we just haven't thought of yet. And staying kind of in a readiness that's relaxed about the possibility of losing everything in that situation or that it could work out. And either way, we'll be okay. So I think it's sort of coming to that a fundamental, like if last week there came up the words inadequacy or wrongness, like if there's the fear or the assumption that I'm inadequate or the fear that I'm inadequate or that I would be, and I'm not really careful or whatever, sometimes it's so helpful to just, well, actually I am inadequate. All right, so then, now what? Now that I know I'm inadequate, still, I'm in this situation, and I still care, and I would love for everyone to get what's needed. And none of us see a way right now. And I still feel like the good feeling, the kind of dewiness and smoothness, roundness, fluidity of the good idea that came up, even though it kind of got trashed before I could even express it. That's still with me, even though it's very shaky and there's a lot at stake. And so then the practice of pause, like knowing that I don't know and staying in receptivity, like demagnetizing from doubt and also with almost like the fingers of our practice, fluffing out what actually is doubt made of? Like what's the kind of tone of voice and what are the kind of sentences? What is it kind of attacking? And what in there is true and what in there is just violence. So just really briefly, we could continue this more if we like tomorrow, but when Gautama Buddha talks about being attacked by doubt, first of all, we know we're in good company if we get attacked by doubt. That it happens, you know, it's not like just you or something. Along the good way it happens. And he said it's like a rich person with lots of wealth traveling through the desert. So that's the experience of doubt. And I love the image. I think it gives a lot to go into. Like, it gives the sense of, because there's so much richness with you, you have something to lose in case there would be bandits in the desert, for example. But you have richness that you could you know, tune into. And that the doubt is sort of like a threat. It's in question. There's a shakiness about, is there richness, is there wealth or not? There is. And then also the dryness of a desert. And then when doubt dissolves on the other side, the person has gotten across the desert without any harm to the person or the party or the riches. So the kind of story that it's scary for a while and things feel under threat, but actually it doesn't get lost. There can be dry periods, there can be periods where we deeply question whether we have anything to offer, etc.
Of self, our possession or our pride or all that we've accumulated in that sense comes with a proportional opportunity for doubt, because it's just the kind of flip side of that built up. So.
Yeah.
But I to look at it the other way.
I think in the context where it's an attack of the hindrance of doubt that is being symbolized by crossing the desert, that kind of points more to healthy wealth, so to speak. Also, it's cool because the first hindrance of wanting, which I love that English word as, so feeling wanting as in terms of there's a feeling of lack, with the metaphor of debt. And the kind of healing of that hindrance is someone starting a business and making enough money to support oneself, one's family, and have more. So it's also a sense of wealth as a healthy thing, rather than an accumulation of sort of incorrect understanding of what I am and all. And so what I feel like is suggested in the metaphor of the desert and the wealth is that even when there's doubt, maybe we can get a felt sense of somehow wealth, somehow the richness of some experience, or somehow the wealth of your being, whether it's in, you know, specific unique gifts or just as a human being, life itself, gratitude, etc. This kind of feeling the generosity of life, how that wealth, whatever it is, was given rather than really something that you stacked up that could fall down. Those kinds of directions can help, rather than necessarily trying to have a conversation with the doubt. Yeah, we could continue more on that. There's a lot there. Another time. Thank you for listening and participating. With listening and speaking. May our practice and lives be lifted with the non-dependence of mind. To our place of belonging. Everywhere we go, for the benefit of all, including ourselves.